Okay, welcome back, one and all. Any lab questions? I would point out that the labs this week we're using magnetic compasses. So if you happen to own a magnetic compass of almost any description that's usable to within about 1 degree, please bring it along, because the department's extensive collection is now whittled down to a very few. So we're going to be a little equipment shy this time around, which is unfortunate. You can buy a good magnetic compass with a mirror for about $22 at a sports shop. Okay, today we're going to move on to position determination. Remember, we've talked about points, lines, area features, and how they're conducted on maps. We're moving on now to talk about navigation. We have a series of lectures on navigation that's going to begin with the points part, or determining position. So we've already covered many ways of finding your direction around in the real world. We've looked at, or rather we haven't yet looked at GPS, we'll do that today. We've looked at using your watch to be able to find where north is on a map. We've looked at using the Big Dipper and the Polaris, the star. And we've covered briefly the compass, magnetic compass, and how that can be used for determining directions both on the ground and on the map. So you can use the compass on the map too, kind of like a protractor with a north arrow. We haven't yet looked at GPS. That's really what we're going to do today. But there's one other topic I want to visit before we get there, and that's the idea of positioning by resection. We didn't cover this last time. We did look at the magnetic compass as a device, but how do we use it in conjunction with the map? That's really what I want to talk about now. So in resection, we use the fact that where we are on the map is going to be determined by the bearings that we can measure off to various features that we can see on the landscape and on the map. So if there's a feature I can see off in the distance, let's say it's a house, and I have magnetic north from my compass direction, I know and understand compass declination, then I can measure the angle between north and what it is that I'm targeting, ideally with the kind of compass that I can look through and target with. And I can use that angle, the angle between north and the feature, to apply a method called resection. And resection simply means taking bearings of features that we can see on the landscape, let's say like a hill, a road junction, or a water tower, measuring the bearing forward to them, and then taking, calculating what's called the back bearing. The back bearing is fairly easy when you think about it. If my bearing is a particular angle from where I am to where the object is, then from the object, my bearing would be the same, plus or minus 180 degrees, because it's looking in the opposite direction. So if I can measure off those angles, calculate their back bearings from each of the features, go to the features on the map and draw a line at the correct angle, then those lines should intersect at a single point that's the location where I actually am. I can do it with two, but it's a bit less reliable. If I can do it with three objects, it can determine where I am. It's still useful to even do it with a single object, because I might be able to say, let's say that I'm on a particular trail or I'm on a particular road and I have that bearing, then there's probably only one place where that criterion is going to be met. So resection, extremely simple thing to do. It can pay in advance when you're hiking, so to even measure resection back bearings from key features, so that you'll know where you are on a trail. Question?
Yeah, is bearing and azimuth, are those two terms interchangeable?
Bearing, I simply mean the direction of one place from another. Okay, the azimuth is the angle between 0 and 360 degrees clockwise from north.
Okay.
So azimuth is only one way of specifying a bearing. I could specify it in several other different ways. So let's take a more simple example. Let's say I'm in Isola, Slovenia. I just happened to pick this one because I had a convenient photograph for it. And I'm standing on, in this case, on a road. And I can see the tower in Isola, the old medieval tower. And I can use my magnetic compass to measure north. And I can measure off an angle. Let's say it comes out at 20 degrees in this particular instance. If I have the same, if I have the map and I can set the bearing of 20 between north and the view line heading from 20 outward from that feature, or 200 rather, 180 plus 20. And in this case, I can see that I I'm on a road. I know that I took that photograph from a road, so I must be on this particular stretch of highway right here because the angles match up. So this is, I can do resection even with a single compass bearing if I know something about the landscape and how to use my map. Extremely powerful thing to be able to do because often we want to have the map and the compass and use them in conjunction to find where we are on the map or on the landscape. That helps a great deal. Okay. But by far the best way to determine your position in the 21st century is to use the global positioning system. So the whole of the rest of today's lecture is about GPS and how it works. You may or may not have met it in this context. If you have, say, a standard, it's called a recreation grade, a global positioning system receiver, you can go out and buy it. This is only about $80 to buy this one. I can simply turn it on, push a button, and within 3 or 4 minutes, I'm told exactly where I am on the landscape. So let's talk about GPS and what it is. Well, it's a satellite-based navigation system, and the more generic term for the global positioning system is a GNSS, or a satellite-based navigation system, a global satellite-based navigation system. This is the one that we're going to deal with. GPS was funded and is still controlled by the United States Department of Defense. In fact, most of the operations are done by the Air Force. And it was designed initially for military tasks, primarily targeting. So it was a way of sending troops, aircraft, missiles, bombs to particular locations. But it was very early on recognized that it was a good example of what's called a dual-use technology, one that probably was much more valuable to civilians than it would ever be to the military. It was configured in such a way that it could be blocked and interrupted for its civilian users. But since 1991, when the system's been operational, and a later presidential decree signified that all the military encryption systems would be turned off on this satellite and it would be open forever for civilian navigation. So this has been around for a while now, 20 years, and has been useful ever since. The global positioning system, or GPS, is only one of five global navigation satellite systems. We're not the only one, and as you can see, this can be a huge benefit in the future. In terms of GPS, the US-based system, we've expended all of the Block 1, that's the first generation satellites in the system. We're on the way to finishing the Block 2 revisions. We're currently working on Block 2R, as it's called, in the latest launches. And the new satellites, as they're replacing the old ones, are vastly superior technologically. So they're really beginning to supply a next generation in terms of GPS capabilities. Basically, that means it's getting more and more accurate, but it means other things besides. For example, the Block 2 is designed to resemble the European Galileo system and to actually have a two-way communications for emergency search and rescue. So if you're at sea, you can actually use the GPS system to upload your position to the system and then to receive an acknowledgement that you have actually been located and that help is on the way. Other systems, if we sort of track forward in time, the closest successor to the GPS was the Russian GLONASS system. GLONASS was designed and initially became operational in the last days of the fall of the old Soviet Union. And in fact, after the fall of the Soviet Union, it fell into disrepair, began to degrade as a system, but it's since been upgraded and has been made operational all over again. There's a GLONASS receiver that you might use if you're in the Russian military. Many people think that's a mock-up to make it look like it's old and ugly. But this is the latest Chinese cell phone that you can get that is an integrated GPS and GLONASS receiver for its navigation system. So it's using two navigation systems, which has advantages that will become obvious in a little while. Okay, then we have our third system, which has been proposed by the European Union, and its initial launches are now taking place, so it's more than just on the drawing board. It's now a beginning to be constructed. It's called Galileo. It's actually slightly superior to the GPS system, although it doesn't work yet. It may not for a little while. 2014 is intended to be its first operational year. The Chinese have a system called Beidou, or Compass, which is still under development. It's currently not operational globally, but it is operational regionally over the landmass of China, so it's able to be used for navigation within China. And the Indians have a similar system, although it's probably never going to be made into a global system, and that's the IRNSS. That's designed to cover the continent of India and its territory out to 2,000 kilometers from its shoreline, so it covers all the local ocean traffic. So this is what GNSSs are. If you haven't encountered these, you're going to meet them quite extensively over the next few years. GNSS consists of at least a space segment. That's the bits of it that are in orbit, usually around the Earth, and that maintain the orbits of the satellites. A ground segment that deals with control of the system and updates it and improves it and makes sure that it continues to be accurate. And then a user segment. And the user segment can be as simple as owning and operating a device like this that allows you to receive the signals. So there's a couple of slides on the space segment. The idea of GPS is that there's a series of space vehicles that are in orbit. 24 of them are operational, although there can be as many as 30. I believe there are 31 in orbit right now. Some of them function as spares. The GPS is actually figuring out how to cram more than I think it's 4 satellites into a single orbit so that they can actually improve accuracy using their spares. So what do? They simply send actually rather weak radio signals from an atomic clock on board the satellite. These are atomic clock signals are integrated into a pseudo-random number sequence. So they've got a digital transmitter encoding a random number sequence on it that's unique. And on top of that is layered the carrier for the atomic clock and some other data called the ephemeris data. So the constellation, it's nominally, the way it was designed was to have 24 satellites that orbit the Earth every 12 hours, and they're actually in a series of tracks. We'll show you the tracks they're in just a second. But they're often more than 24. Some are put in what are called parking orbits, which means that they're launched and then sort of parked in space, just left so that they can be moved into operation if, say, another satellite fails or if there's a strategic need for accurate locations in a particular part of the Earth. So this is the tracks of the satellites. You'll notice that they kind of look like bands going around the Earth. There's a series of tracks at different angles. There are multiple satellites on each track. And the goal of this is that if you're at any place in the Earth, imagine here's the entire constellation. At any place in the Earth, 24 hours a day, you'll be able to see at least 4 satellites within your line of sight. And preferably many more, and sometimes you can track up to 9 and sometimes as many as 12 satellites at a single time. So being able to see the satellite from the receiver is very important, which is why I'm not going to turn this one in here, because it's not going to see any satellites because I'm inside a building. The control segment that manages all the satellites and their orbits, repositions and recalibrates the satellites, that tracks them, and that sends subtle changes and improvements, basically time delays or additions on the atomic clocks to keep them all in sequence. There's a worldwide tracking network. I'll show it in just a second. The master control facility is at Schriever Air Force Base in Colorado. There's the entranceway to the Air Force Base. And the models, well, they run a series of computer models that compute precise orbital data, what's called an ephemeris, and the space vehicle clock corrections for each satellite. So they have a very elaborate three-dimensional model that figures out where each satellite is in its orbit at any given time, knows what the time is there, and uploads to it its precise positional parameters. So each satellite knows where it is and is continuously sending that as part of its signal. That's what's called the ephemeris part of the signal. And then the space vehicles send the ephemeris data and the what's called the pseudo-ranges, the transmissions from its atomic clock, directly to GPS receivers over radio signals. And there's no mystery behind this. They're microwave signals in the L1, L2 microwave bands. They can pick them up within almost any radio receiver. They're pretty straightforward radio signals. The monitoring network of all these consists of a worldwide set, primarily at U.S. Military institutions, that monitors the satellites and is able to correct their orbits and correct the data coming from each one. So these positions, NGA, recently moved to Fort Belvoir, Shriver, Hawaii, it's on Oahu, in the United Kingdom, Bahrain, Diego Garcia, Australia. These places monitor the orbits of the satellites and continuously relay that exact data back to Shriver Air Force Base, where they make sure whether or not additions or corrections are necessary to the time signals. Okay, it works like this. If I'm at any position on the Earth's surface and I turn on my receiver, I'm getting multiple signals from many satellites, ideally as many as possible, but let's say at least three, if I'm going to fix my position. Each one of those is transmitting the same signal, but it's sending it at slightly different times. So I've got radio signals that are slightly out of synchronization with each other, purely because they've traveled different distances to get there, because they're coming from different orbits of the satellite. So I might have a pseudo-random number signal that looks like this, and I can look for exactly the same, these two peaks here, in this signal, and now I can simply measure the displacement between those two signals and figure out how much of a wavelength that is, and that allows me to calculate the actual length that the signal has traveled from the satellite to the receiver. That can be measured with surprising accuracy, although there are some problems, as we'll look at in just a second. These distances are called pseudo-ranges. That's the total distance that has traveled. It's pseudo-range because it's kind of like not in a straight line, because the radio signals, as they hit the Earth's atmosphere, refract. They're influenced by the ionosphere. They're changed in all sorts of ways before they actually reach the receiver. So if we need to calculate X, Y, and Z, the location of where we are on the Earth's surface, we need at least four satellites, because we need one redundancy to be able to solve those simultaneous equations for three variables. We also get time as a sort of side benefit. Time, not just time, time to an extraordinary degree of accuracy, because it's coming from multiple atomic clocks with extremely low error rates. And as I said, the time signal's embedded in this pseudo-random number sequence, and it's the periodicity in the random number sequence that's another control on the effect of the accuracy of the signal as it can be received. So, if we take our receiver outside, turn it on and hold it up, usually the first thing it goes into is what's called satellite search mode, and if you want to, you can pull up a little display that shows you where the satellites are at any given point in the sky. Now, let's try and make some sense of these diagrams. Let's say that we can look up, lie on your back and look up, and if we have a map of the entire view of space from the ground, we can think of the track of any one particular satellite as forming an arc crossing our line of visibility. So we might have a satellite that comes through that red arrow across a particular view. They move kind of fast. I mean, faster than you might think. I've often been able to pick them out at night and actually see the light shining on them. And you can see that they're actually tracking across the sky at measurable speed. You can see them moving. Just as some are up high in the sky and accessible to you, others are down low at different parts of the sky. Some are setting as others are rising, so the constellation itself is changing continuously. One problem is that we would like our view, lying on our backs looking up, to be unobscured in every direction, but that's not necessarily going to always be the case, depending upon where we are on the Earth's surface. So part of the ephemeris means figuring out where all the satellites are going to be, which ones are going to be visible, and what their position is, what the position of the constellation is going to be in the sky at any particular time. Obviously, if they're all bunched in one part of the sky, that's not as good as having them distributed uniformly across the sky. So each of the satellites, and often a receiver will show you this, we can see which satellites are going to be available at what times and where they're going to be positioned in the sky. We can plot and know this in advance and know a little bit about what kind of accuracy or error to anticipate at any given time. Back when I started working with GPS, when it was still only a partial system, there were very few satellites in orbit, and as a result, you could only get a fix from like 3 a.m. to 3:10 a.m., you know, on a Thursday or something like that. So you'd have to go out and have your receiver running, and better make sure you get the data logged while it's actually able to receive the data. As the constellations become more and more populated with more and more satellites, the gaps, when you can't see anything, have been reduced now to zero. And that includes everywhere on Earth, including the poles and the oceans. Where doesn't it work? Well, it's not a very powerful radio signal. And not very powerful radio signals don't do a good job of penetrating concrete or rock or dirt or vegetation. So here's three places where, or four rather, where GPS doesn't work very well. It doesn't work indoors, and that can be a real problem because you know often you'd like to know where you are within a building, but it's not going to work for you. It doesn't work underground, and for some reason the Department of Defense has enormous interest in things that are underground and would like to know how to navigate down there. It doesn't work underwater, which means that you can't use it in, say, a submarine. It works very well on the ocean surface, usually because of perfect line of sight when you're on a ship. But underwater, you have this problem that the water acts as a buffer to the signal, although there are ways of getting around this. Submarines, for example, can send out a little pod that floats to the surface connected by a cable that opens up a GPS receiver, gets its position, and we can pull the pod back down into the submarine. And, of course, it doesn't work well when we've got something obscuring the horizon. So we've got all sorts of natural canyons where we're going to have far less view of the overhead sky down in the bottom of the canyon than we do otherwise. Or we've got artificial canyons like city streets where we're deep down within residential streets, say, and tall buildings on either side, we're not going to be able to get the signals very well in those areas. In fact, the last time I was in New York City, I hailed a cab at, over by Times Square, and it didn't pick up the GPS signal until it drove out across the Triborough Bridge towards Queens. So the whole time it was in Midtown Manhattan, it couldn't get a single fix. All the New York City cabs have GPS equipped with them now. The other place it's not going to work is under a very dense tree canopy, or actually under almost any tree canopy. Tropical rainforest, which has a lot of dense, heavy growth trees, the hardwoods, those act pretty much like concrete as far as the GPS signal is concerned. They really impede the signal. So in areas where you'd like to be able to navigate, like say under jungle canopy, again you can have problems with GPS. There are workarounds to this, and some are being improved continuously. Now, if you have an iPhone or any kind of recent generation telephone, you have a GPS chip within it. In fact, I know the FCC just said that every cell phone is going to have a GPS chip within it by, I think it's 2017, or it has to by law. And that's because when you pick up a landline phone and call 911, the dispatcher immediately knows where you are. They've got your fixed address where your phone is registered. But that's not the case with a cell phone. Was it now? 70% of all emergency phone calls come on cell phones, not on landline phones, so that we really need to know where the receiver is located, and therefore the cell phone chip is able to do that. There's a second navigational technique within these as well that uses the actual tower that's receiving the signal that triangulates from the towers, but it's GPS that kind of wins out in the end. Here's a piece of software on my iPhone called MotionX. That actually enables your phone to be a GPS receiver and turns it into a recreation-grade GPS receiver, just much like this one over here. And it's logged my particular position. In this case, I walked from my office over to where I used to give my lectures over here, on the other side of campus. And just a couple of things to point out. You can see that the blue line is just down. I just took the data from the software and downloaded it into my GIS package, and then plotted it with the base map underneath. In fact, this is in Google Earth. It goes directly into Google Earth. And you can see that it does a pretty good job at first as I walk out of my office in Ellison Hall down here and take a curve. But look, as I walk along this path, you see that my signal slowly drifts over into the trees and on the dirt. Trust me, I didn't walk on the trees and in the dirt. It's pretty good here, but then it drifts inside a building when I was clearly not inside the building. So there's some error contained within the signal. It's not a huge error, you know, it's not sort of a life-threatening error, but it could be under certain circumstances. So let's look at GPS error, because it's error in positioning that determines how useful the signal is going to be or how accurately it can position us. We know now, having learned a little bit about coordinate systems, that we can store locations with different degrees of precision. It would be nice if our precision matched up with our accuracy. So if we were locating things to a meter, then we actually were confident that they were located within a meter in their correct positions. So let's look at what's called an error budget for GPS. And GPS error consists of a combination of three things. Noise is random variation in the system. That's measurement error. We're going to be able to control that only by improving the system and its properties and its operating characteristics. Bias errors are systematic errors that result in what's often called drift. So the fact that my signal was moving slowly further and further away from where it should have been, was drifting, in that case, towards the north. That's a bias error where a series of results all comes out with the same error within them. And a blunder error would be if, say, I measured my position with great accuracy and then wrote the latitude down instead of the longitude first and switched them. Okay, then I'd be definitely in the wrong location and it was just my blunder on my part. Or I wrote an 8 instead of a 5 or something like that. Okay, so what are the sources of errors? Well, they come in this way. Pseudo-random number generator itself, how closely can I bed this time signal in to get my digital sequence and still maintain it as a sequence? That results in about 1 meter on the ground. Okay, the receiver noise, that's the noise associated with the measurement receiver, is going to add about another meter. So at worst, I'm now up to 2 meters. And these are what are called root mean squared errors. That means that if I take the average distance that I am in any direction, these sort of describe a circle around exactly where I am. In fact, many in-vehicle navigation systems that use GPS have a dot where your current location is, and as the signal gets better or worse, that dot turns into a circle, and the circle gets larger and larger radius as your signal is less and less accurate. As it kind of tightens back on a dot, then you're getting more and more accurate signal. Okay, bias errors were deliberately placed into the signal by a system called selective availability and some other factors. So selective availability was the ability of the Defense Department to throw a switch and all of a sudden degrade the accuracy of everybody's GPS receiver. This is very good under some circumstances, but it means that once you turn that switch off, all the civilian, or what are called the CA codes, become degraded, but the military codes, the P codes, which are independent of the civilian system, those don't get degraded. So now my enemy can't get good GPS fixes, but I can. That was the logic behind it. Selective availability was turned off about 2000, 2001 by presidential decree, and I think we can safely assume that this was done when we had developed the ability to flip a switch and turn off an entire country's GPS reception at whim. Okay, so that used to be 30 to 100 meters error. Now that's zero because we've turned it off. One of the first projects I ever did with GPS was to map health clinics in West Africa, and we did this by sending over some very first generation, extremely old GPS receivers through the diplomatic pouch and giving them to Peace Corps volunteers, who then quickly mapped the country of Togo on their motorcycles. And they happened to do this at exactly the time the first Gulf War was starting, Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. As a result, they turned off selective availability. We got beautiful maps of the health clinics of Togo, and then as soon as the war ended, they turned SA back on again. Fortunately, that's now turned off permanently. So the space vehicle clock errors, that's the control actually on the atomic clocks within the different satellites. about another meter. But apparently the next generation satellites are going to have so vastly improved atomic clocks on board that that meter will be down to millimeters. That would be a massive drop in terms of capability there. The ephemeris data errors, this is in the telling the system where the different satellites are within the constellation, adds about another meter. Tropospheric delays, that's the delays in the signal as it moves through the troposphere, part of the atmosphere, about another meter. And then the ionosphere, nasty thing, which interferes with radio signals to quite an extent, adds 10 meters. So that's the principal source of error in the GPS signal is delays in the ionosphere, or unmodeled ionospheric delays. So the ionosphere is not our friend if we are GPS users. Now, part of that delay error causes one of the biggest bugaboos of GPS, which is multipath error. What's multipath error? Well, the enormous difference in the signal, if we're standing in an open area, look at that, that's before they even put the artificial surface on the rec center field. If you're standing out in the open, your horizon's relatively unobscured, you don't have too much trouble in receiving the signal from any of the satellites surrounding you. I think there's got a little animation on this slide. Let's see. Okay, so we can receive GPS signals from anywhere within our field of view, and those become useful and allow us to calculate our position. If we're here, standing right next to the old rec center building, we get this problem, that a satellite signal heading off over here, which we would never have received, bounces off the side of the building and then arrives at the receiver, and the receiver now believes that this length is its pseudo range. So it's a signal we would never have received, and it's got the wrong length associated with it. So when we put that into the equations, it adds an error term, a significant error term to our signal. Multipath error is almost certainly the cause for the drift on my Motion X signal as I was going past some of the taller buildings on the way across campus. How do we quantify GPS error? Well, we divide it up into DOPs. Okay, DOP stands for dilution of precision. It's just the term they use for it. And the general dilution of precision, or the GDOP, is generally the number that you're going to be quoted as the strength of the signal. GDOP goes from zero, which means the signal is perfect and has no error associated with it at all, through about 2, which is still a very good signal, through about 5, which is a partially degraded signal, through about 7 or 8, at which case the signal is so degraded that you can probably only get lat long from it and not elevation, up to values in excess of 20, which are so poor that you should just throw away the value that you have altogether. It's just not very useful. The components of DOP, well, we have position dilution of precision, or what's called the 3D or the spherical DOP, which is the overall three-dimensional pattern of the distortion. So this you can think of as if I'm standing at this particular location, I'm looking up at the sky, and I have a constellation of satellites, that constellation and three-dimensional relationships are the three-dimensional dilution of the precision. We can look at just the HDOP, or the horizontal dilution of precision, if all we want are the latitude and longitude. We don't care about our elevation. We do want to determine exactly where we are with a great deal of precision. That's if we're putting ourselves on the map. VDOP has to do with the vertical dilution of precision. That's our height. And generally speaking, GPS is at least twice as accurate in latitude and longitude as it is in terms of height. It's much harder to get an elevation with respect to the datum than it is with respect to position. Just personally, I believe that's deliberate because it's a good way to make sure you don't hit things is to know exactly how high they are. And lastly, we have TDOT. The TDOT has to do with the time factor. So the more accurate our atomic clock and the faster the pulse with which it's able to send out its signal, the more accurate our signal is going to be overall. All of those four factors are contributors to the GDOP, or the general dilution of precision within the system. Now, if those are relatively known and controllable, and we know about things like multipath error and geometric effects, you might say, how could we go about actually correcting the signal to make them more accurate? So what I'm going to talk about now for the rest of the lecture is, we'll start with something like the CA, or the course acquisition code, the recreational grade fix that I might get with my regular receiver, how can I make that more accurate? And in fact, we can indeed do so. We can make it extremely accurate given the right circumstances. Well, the first and the most effective way is to use something called the Wide Area Augmentation System, or WAAS. And in fact, I have it on this GPS receiver. I can just turn it on and select it from the menu to initialize it. And what does that do? Well, it makes this into a receiver from not one, but two satellite signals. The first, those coming from the GPS satellites, and then secondly, digital corrections to the signal coming from another network that's being operated actually by a combination of the National Geodetic Survey and the Coast Guard. Okay, so what is the Wide Area Augmentation System? It comes from a network of GPS receivers sitting at known locations that are all the time measuring not their position, but the current signal's difference from that position. Okay, so you can imagine that if you've got a GPS receiver sitting here, it's absolutely, you know, we've had that receiver running for 5 years, so we know the location of that point with enormous precision. And the current position that I'm getting from the satellite's telling me that it's here. Then I know that I've got this much error, and it's in that direction. So if I can translate that fact into a radio signal, send it to the receiver, it can say, well, if I'm near that receiver, then the chances are that I've got the same error applying to my signal here. So I can apply that correction instantaneously to it. I can implement the Wide Area Augmentation System and correct my signal. Now, all those sources of error I just gave you, including that ionospheric error of 10 meters or so, once I implement WAAS, a typical error on a system like this that might be 15 to 20 meters, perhaps 10 to 15 if you're lucky, suddenly jumps right down when I put WAAS into about 1 to 3 meters. Okay, it makes it a lot more precise. 1 to 3 meters, that's, you know, that's getting pretty accurate. It's like between here and the table. WAAS is based on a series of point transmitters. Originally, it was set up just to cover the coastlines of the United States. And it was supplemented by a broadcast network by the Coast Guard that set up regular radio transmitters to send out the signals. Then it became a satellite transmission system that was able to cover the entire country. And in fact, there are now European equivalents. There are Indian, Chinese equivalents and so on that cover much of the rest of the world. So now you can pretty much always update your GPS signal from one form or another of WAAS. But sometimes that's still not good enough. We'd like to get even more accurate. And there we can use a technique called differential correction. Now, differential correction is actually what WAAS is doing, but in a slightly different context. What do we need? Well, in differential GPS, we have really two receivers. We take one and we leave it in a fixed location. It's called the base station. So let's say we set up on this tripod, and we would like it to be as close as possible to our rover, or our second system that's going to actually move around and collect the data. They're getting the same satellite signals at the same time, but since one is at a fixed location, and we know that location, we can calculate those errors. And after the fact, if we log both tracks from the receiver and the base station, we can then bring them together in software and correct the GPS positions to put them in their correct location. Now, you used to have to buy this as a service. You know, for one thing, you'd have to buy two GPS receivers of pretty high accuracy and maintain and log them continuously. But again, now the National Geodetic Survey is taking over and handling many of these functions for us and has open websites that allow us to download differential corrections. So differential GPS removes the common mode errors, those errors that are common to the receiver and to the reference frame. That's a big chunk of those 1 meter and the 10 meter errors that we saw in the error budget. Errors are more common when the receivers are together. So as the base and the ranger get closer and closer together, the corrections get better and better. If they're a long distance apart, they're not going to be so good. Differential position accuracies of 1 to 10 meters are possible. Well, we've actually come a little ways since then. We can now regularly get down to about 60 to 70 centimeters with differential correction. But the special software is necessary to do what's called carrier phase differential, which I'll introduce in the next slide. So this basically means that since I've now got differential correction capabilities on almost any receiver, I can post-process my position data and make it a great deal more accurate. What I need to do is save the time log on all of the readings that I took, so I knew what the constellation looked like at that time, and I need to save what are called the pseudo ranges within the data set so I can actually correct them and then reissue the correct result. Okay, that's how differential works. So here's a couple of examples just to show you how it works. Here are some points taken out in the field on this topographic map area. We're out in, I don't know where we are, but we're out in what looks like reasonably mountainous trail country, and we're off the trail, so we're on the stream beds and so on. So here's 5 points collected with the GPS receiver before they've been differentially corrected. So what are the likely sources of error? Well, multipath or obscuration of the satellites can tell us that the valleys, down in the valleys, or whether terrain the obscurations of the signal, we're going to get the worst. So when we apply the differential correction, that gives us our green values. You see that some of the points, like the ones on exposed areas, don't change very much, perhaps a half a meter or so. Some change quite a bit, like the red one to the white one there by Doogie Springs. And then in some cases, we've got points that were at different locations that become the same location. So if we're not moving the receiver, we can still have drift in the signal we're getting at that position. So it can look like multiple points, whereas in fact it's the same location. Not a good thing to do if you're trying to navigate, say, a speeding ambulance with one of these things. Here's some work that one of my former students did around campus, in which he mapped a series of locations and then differentially corrected them and did a sort of error analysis of where the worst errors were. So really what he's doing here is figuring out where multipath error is. So in the blue areas, it was kind of neutral. The correction, or the GPS, actually gave a better system before it was corrected. In the red areas, the differential signal is much better. And you see that those are areas where we're lying sort of in the shadow of buildings, so we've got part of the skyline is obscured, or we're under vegetation canopy, like here in front. This is Ellison Hall. There's Campbell Hall up there. Under the trees here, we get worse signals, and they're corrected and improved by differential GPS. So these signal corrections can make an enormous difference and a big improvement in terms of mapping. Differential GPS gets used extensively. This guy runs a climbing business in the Alps, and here's his ascent and descent logged, differentially corrected, and then rendered in 3D over his ascent of, I forget what the name of the mountain was. And as a result, we're seeing the little tiny GPS chips are now about the size of a nickel. They're very, very small. They can be integrated into commodity items, and so sensing position has become pretty commonplace. You can get all sorts of things. You can get a differentially mappable kid's backpack, so you can always see where your kids are, for example. So a major breakthrough here was when GPS started getting integrated into portable gadgets. Here's the original Casio GPS watch. It was kind of big and ugly. The latest generation aimed for joggers, so you can log your path as you're running and then download it and see exactly where you climbed the ascent, what speed you were doing the whole time. Watches, PDAs, laptops, cell phones, so you can get a GPS USB plug-in for a laptop. It allows you to locate your laptop in real time, and almost any cell phone now has a GPS receiver and can be used to greater or lesser extent. Most common application, or the most commodified, is what is called in-vehicle navigation systems, or IVNS, and these can be as simple as your TomTom that you use in your car to navigate around. I would say, let's ask it inverse. Who drives a car that does not have a GPS navigation system in it? And who with? Still not a majority. Okay, so we haven't flipped over to the most people yet. Well, if you don't have one, you must spend a lot of time lost. That's all I can say. But then remember, these go into anything that's moving. So aircraft, they affect aircraft positioning and navigation. Trains, buses, taxis, almost any fleet vehicle that can be tracked with GPS can then also report its position back, and allows the latest big growth industry in GPS is fleet management software that allows you to, say, manage 100 trucks at the same time, or to locate any one of the 1,000 shipping containers and know exactly where they are at any given time of the day or night. So lots of sort of commodity type applications. Then there are all these cell phone type applications that are extremely important. The ability to be able to know immediately, press a button and know exactly where you are on the map at any given time from your iPhone is very important. I got this image in particular for my new edition, my book. You notice that it's at 000 east. It's in terms of its longitude, it's on the prime meridian. It's actually in London. And then we have, if things are geospatially enabled, if they've got the chip in them, you can do things that are spatial. Here's just some common examples. Foursquare has become a very popular sort of social application on the internet that you can use, again, with mobile technologies where you can check in and claim ownership or win points for being in particular locations. I drove back through Washington a couple of weeks ago, and the guy I was with said, "Quick, I've got to get to Foursquare." And he tapped his phone as I went in and said, "Yeah, I've got it. I'm now the mayor of Dulles Airport." Great. That's what you can do with Foursquare. A new sport, geocaching, takes advantage of GPS, both recreational grade receivers and cell phones, to be able to navigate to geocaches, which are hidden locations with something to find at the location that proves that you've been there, and you can log into the website and log the fact that you've visited that particular cache, and they're often quite difficult to find. It's kind of like a puzzle being able to find these locations. There are multiple ones on campus, by the way, including one in the library. And then if you're a real hardcore map nut, you might get interested in the Degree Confluence project, which for some reason has decided that it wants to place a photograph of every whole degree increment of latitude and longitude and where they intersect in the entire planet onto the web. So, 55 degrees north meets 72 degrees east, that's where they want to get the photograph of whatever is there. So you can go to the Degree Confluence website, confluence.org, and look at pictures of degree confluences all over the world. Whole generations of mobile devices that we're only just beginning to see under development. On the left-hand side is my student Tom Pingle, who's a postdoc with me now, wearing a mobile system that we developed as part of our research, in which the GPS receiver is on his shoulder there, and we're logging and pulling up a map that he can see in that little screen that's suspended in front of his eye. The track stick and its variants are a part of what are becoming called taggers. You can even get magnetized taggers that you can simply walk up and clip on somebody's car, and then you can track their car exactly where it goes at any given time. The track stick, you can wear it like a pen in your pocket, and it logs where you are about once every 15 seconds, I think it is. There's the latest generation GPS chip. They're, 6 millimeters across now, so they're getting pretty small. On the right-hand side is one of several GPS-enabled jackets that are used for hiking and skiing and have emergency alert systems on them. So if you fall on the top of the mountain while you're extreme skiing, all you've got to do is that, and your position is encoded, sent out to the ski patrol, and they can come and get you. And a single one of those jackets is like 1/10 of the cost of one search and rescue operation. So they're easily justified. In fact, some national parks are being able to actually issuing GPS receivers because they save so much money. What is carrier phase tracking? Well, it's extreme GPS. Just as we've gotten better and better at using the system, we've started a new set of signals that actually that uses that catches the front of the L1 carrier wave. It detects the leading edge of the wave, and that allows you to get a fraction of the number of waves that it's passed to actually add to the end to get a much more accurate result. If you can track this, you have to do differential correction with it. The carrier wavelength is 19 centimeters, it's in the microwave, so it adds a relatively small distance, but it makes a huge difference in the fix. So the accuracy after carrier phase differential correction is now not meters or even centimeters, it's millimeters. Okay? It's so accurate you can actually measure continental drift and things like that with the carrier phase measurements. Carrier phase survey is a little bit more expensive. So the government's taken over and has set up a network that links them all together. This is the California Spatial Reference Center that coordinates GPS data for the state of California. The National Geodetic Survey has the same thing nationally. It operates a system called Continuously Operating Reference Stations, or CORS stations, and there are two of them on this campus, one at Colo Point Reserve and one in Bio Building. And those are logging and continuously returning signals that you can download. That's usually one signal a second or sometimes more frequent. So you can get your own differential corrections directly from UCSB. There's the network for the whole United States, the CORS network. There's the receiver at Colo Point Reserve that you can go and visit and download its signal if you want to from the internet. Here's a new addition to the CORS network that hasn't even been logged in yet, which we put on the top of Ellison Hall in the spring with our own antenna that's again continuously logging and posting to the internet the GPS signal so it can be differentially corrected. So here's the wrap-up. There are many ways to approximate position in the field. We've looked at map and compass resection, and those are pretty good rough and ready methods. They'll put you on the trail at approximately the right spot. But if you want to really know where you are, you need GPS. GPS is one of several, or actually five, global navigation satellite systems. It works best under a specific set of circumstances. I've covered those circumstances. They're capable, just unaided, they're assisted of about 30 meter accuracy. Those are kind of worst case. With differential corrections, 1 to 10 meters. With the wide area system, wide area augmentation system, 1 to 7 meters is common, but often better than half a meter. And with carrier phase, we can locate you within millimeters. Okay, see you on Wednesday.